Blog Talk Radio.
This is Port of Harlem Talk Radio, and I'm your host for this show and also publisher of Port of Harlem Magazine at portofharlem.net. If you're listening via the internet, you can type your questions in the comment box. You can also call and listen by dialing on your phone 516-531-9540. And if you want to ask a question after you are connected, press 1 and please be in a quiet place. You can also visit portofharlem.net and click Port of Harlem Talk Radio from the menu to hear this and past episodes. We are also available on about 7 podcast platforms. And lastly, We Talk Productions sponsors Port of Harlem Talk Radio. Our first guest is Marvin Sin. Marvin is an artist and leather craftsman who sells his bags and other accessories at private shows and cultural festivals with his wife, Akusia Vandele. He is now collaborating with a Bahamian on a project in Ghana. The Pan-African project marries African-American design talent with Ghanaian production capacity. Welcome, Marvin.
Thank you, Wayne. Glad to be with you, brother.
Yeah, I'm glad to. I think this is probably the first conversation I've actually ever had with you, even though I've seen you for decades, it seems.
True that. Yeah.
So I know your goal is generally to replicate what so many businesses have done, and that is to employ people in low-cost labor communities. Would that be a fair description?
Absolutely. I've been applying my trade, making bags and selling them, for over 50 years. And it occurred to me that as much as I consider myself independent, pan-African, African-centered, that all the fruits of my labor have been plowed back into the American, system. And that I never have really had an opportunity or a connection or an opportunity to utilize my skill set to benefit, Africa in any way. And, I guess 90% of my designs, my imagery, my art is inspired by Africa. And so I've always wanted to make the connection in a meaningful way. And, I've got the opportunity working with a good friend, Andrew Wilson, from Nassau in the Bahamas, to attempt to transfer my production to Ghana so that I would be using local artisans to produce my work in Ghana, particularly in Kumasi, and hopefully export it back to the U.S. and sell it through e-commerce platforms, more broadly.
So I guess I know this could be a stupid question for many, but I'm going to ask it so that you can explain it to those who may not find it as being such a simple question. But you're going to a low-cost labor community, so instead of, say, Vietnam, why Ghana?
Well, I think we've just witnessed in the last couple of decades two or three Asian countries deploy the strategy of parlaying their low labor costs into an economic development process that substantially benefited the local population. If we look at what China has done, their labor costs were virtually negligible and enticed, a whole generation of U.S. manufacturers to have their products made in China. And in the process, it generated huge profits here, but also produced a booming Chinese middle class and lifted, tens of millions of people out of poverty. And I think we've seen that in other Asian countries, Indonesia, Vietnam, a few other places where they've used that formula. And, you know, the creative talent in Africa is phenomenal, but I think it needs the input from the diaspora to connect and deliver those products to a global market. So that's our concept, just following what we've seen other cultures do, but to do it in our homeland.
Right. I'm sure that you're, for those who have Pan-African leanings or knowledge of Pan-African teachings, I'm sure your thought process of looking at the world from a Pan-African perspective, or at least somewhat of a Pan-African perspective, I don't know how deep you are into the concept, but I guess that had a impact on your decision to at least go to Africa, if not Ghana in particular.
Most definitely. I mean, my concept of Pan-Africanism is rooted in culture as opposed to politics. I think what we witnessed, you know, for the last few decades is nation states, heads of state, governments in Africa attempting to form various unions and collaborations. And while that has, you know, proceeded very slowly, from a cultural perspective, you know, Pan-Africanism has existed in our communities for decades. I mean, you know, we connect with and embrace each other no matter where you're from, whether it's from the islands or the continent or any part of the States or South America, whether it's Brazil. We see each other as brothers and sisters in a cultural context. We're not even dealing with your political affiliation or the territory you were born in. You know, our cultural Pan-Africanism transcends borders. So it is natural, you know, for me and people of my spirit, particularly the artists, to want to make, you know, these bonds and connections in that vein. And, you know, I think we've waited long enough for the politicians to create a Pan-African reality. I think it's time that we embrace the cultural Pan-African reality that already exists and build upon it. So we're artists, we're working with other artists around the world. So this is simply an elaboration of that process, of that thought process.
Yeah, one of the key words you used, in my opinion, was the word transcend, that you didn't look at whether or not, I guess that's to say, you look at them or they look at you as to what country you were born and raised in. All those boundaries meant nothing, but you let the culture transcend all of that. But what I think is even more distinct about your efforts is that you see yourself as an artist, as a cultural person, but you're actually involving yourself in the economic interest or economic endeavor. So how do you feel about being characterized that way?
I mean, that's 100% spot on. In the late 80s, we launched this concept of black gold, which was kind of putting to words the idea that our art, our culture is really, and our creativity is really our true raw material. It's our natural resource. And just like any other natural resource, we should be able to develop it, produce products, goods and services out of it, and add value to it so that it becomes a viable economic commodity. Heretofore, you know, I think we have relied on other people to take our cultural and creative resource.
And then sell it back to us.
And sell it right back to us. Well, hey, you know,
that's a Facebook meme.
Yeah, so it's, you know, enough of that. And just as we're conceptualizing this on a cultural perspective, you know, I see evidence on the continent that, you know, some of the nation states are waking up to this reality and taking control of their natural resources, limited as it may be at this time, but that trend is in motion where they're taking control of their natural resources, not exporting them as raw materials, only to have to import them back and pay a premium for something that they own and control. So we see it happening on that level as well, but, you know, it's natural here because in the realm of culture, you know, we are obviously the creators and the consumers. If we are the creators and the consumers, and that was the two ends of the system, why shouldn't we also populate all the spaces in between, whether that's design, production, distribution, marketing, you know,
wholesalers,
as well as creating and consuming.
Exactly. I appreciate you putting that, making that so plain and clear, at least to me. Hopefully it was also understood that. And we're going to let people remind them how they can call in 1 second. Was this your first trip to Ghana?
No, my first trip to Ghana was actually in 1977. I went to Ghana right after FESTAC in Nigeria, the International Cultural Festival. From there, I have a friend who's Ghanaian, and, you know, I told him I wanted to visit, and he invited me to connect with his family. So when I went to Ghana, I stayed with his family, and that was my first experience, and, you know, it was like being at home. I mean, it reminded me so much of the South, where my family is from. I'm living now in North Carolina, but it's so close to the Southern experience. It's so close to the Caribbean experience. I've spent a lot of time traveling throughout the Caribbean, and, you know, the connection, the cultural connection is seamless. I mean, you know, whether it's in food, attitude, humor, perspectives, I mean, just relationships. Yeah, clearly we are all cut from the same cloth. And it's time that we, you know, stop letting these artificial nation-state borders separate us. We need to connect with each other beyond these borders.
Okay, I'm going to remind our listeners that if you want to ask a question, dial 516-531-9540, and once you're connected, press 1, and I should be able to see that you want to ask a question. But be patient with me. Hopefully I'll see it, and I'm going to look. And we're going to move on and finish talking with Marvin. How much success did you have on this trip to Ghana with this particular project of having people there create your letter artwork, and can you describe that success?
Well, I mean, the last trip, in fact, I just got back a few weeks ago. I was there the end of March to the middle of April, sort of, and my intention had been to find people to train to do the two critical elements of my work. My work fuses fine art and leathercraft production. So these are two separate things, making a bag and rendering the art, the imagery, painting it is another element. That's why I call my work the art of leather. And much to my surprise, you know, I connected almost immediately with a group of artists at the National Cultural Center in Kumasi, who I invited to come and experiment with my, you know, some of my pieces to see if they would paint them, what, you know, how they would deal with it. They jumped right on it and knocked it out of the park. It was like amazing. So there was no training required.
Well, that was a happy day.
And then on the other hand, I had just been connected through a Ghanaian friend who's been a very vital resource. She lives in St. Louis. She told me about brother that she worked with who had made some bags for her was trained in Turkey and was in Kumasi. So she put me in touch with him. I met with him and his production staff, and they are able to create bags better than I can. I mean, their craftsmanship exceeds my own. I mean, I'm more of an artist than a craftsman, but, you know, I've learned as I went along, but these guys are masters, man. So within, you know, the space of 2 weeks, you know, I had resolved the two major issues. So it was a phenomenal success. While I was there, I was also able to completely set up my workshop there. So on my next trip, awaiting the arrival of some leather that I'm shipping to Ghana, once that's there and I return, we'll be able to start production of a number of objects, hopefully to have them ready in time for the holidays, you know.
So in general, what's the process? You design what here, and then what do you take there for them to copy or to replicate in terms of design?
Yeah, pretty much, you know, I've got to conceptualize the art imagery or the design imagery. So that's a process that's created separately. I'll either do some of that here, I'll do some of that there. Those elements then would be painted by the artist there. Separately, you know, I've got to create the actual bag structure, the actual components from putting a bag together, complete with the linings, the zippers, the straps, the hardware, all of that. And the last step would be combining the finished artwork with a almost completed bag. Once the artwork then is attached to the bag, simply sewing up the flap and adding the hardware, and it's ready to go. And smaller things like wallets and card cases and things will already be made, and they'll be painting on those. So once they're painted, they're finished.
So I guess I have to just make it clear that, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the big thing is that once you create a design, whether the paint, the image design, and the design of the item itself, the labor cost really hits home when it comes to putting the thing together. And that's what you're saving by being in a low cost labor country.
Oh, no question. I mean, the pandemic, you know, has crippled most economies on the continent. So there are, you know, there's an abundance of college-educated, eager-to-work people at all skill set levels. And, you know, the labor cost is perhaps maybe, you know, 20% of, or less of what we would normally encounter here. And the cost of living there is much lower as well. I mean, as we kind of, you know, shifted out, it costs so much more to live here than it does in Africa. Just some of the basic expenses that we have are astronomical compared to their counterparts in Ghana, for example. And so on a lower salary, you're able to live a decent life. Without, you know, a lot of the expenses that we incur here and take for granted. So my other concern is, you know, I think most other ethnicities and cultures and immigrants from other nations, when they come to the United States, it's specifically for the purpose of making money, to get a good job. While many of them actually stay here, they also are sending a good portion of their earned income back to their families and then native countries.
All the extended family.
Extended family.
Yeah.
And, well, you know, on the continent, your family is extended. So, you know, it's not just your nuclear family, but your aunts and uncles and nieces and nephews and cousins. I mean, you know, you're trying to look out for everybody. You're trying to cover school fees and you know, household expenses and electricity and water and all kinds of expenses that, you know, the money that we would send or that they send, you know, goes a long way to improving the standard of living there for their families. And I think we need to have the same kind of concept. I think what I regret is not having a system whereby some significant portion of the money that I'm earning from creating art that is based on African spirituality and creativity should be going to Africa and not to, you know, Bank of America or Verizon or, you know, whoever else is taking my money every month, and car notes and house notes and you know, all the money that I've made, I've spent here. And I regret that I did not have a system in place to transfer some of that income to a place where it could have done much more good.
But you're correcting it now.
I'm correcting that now. I mean, I I'm encouraging other people. It's like if we are truly calling ourselves African Americans, we need to embrace that African part of our identity. You know, I mean, there's no question that we are of African origin. I mean, we didn't get our blackness from the plantation. We brought it here when we came. And whether or not, you know, you trace your heritage to a specific tribe or nation, you know, we have the opportunity and I think the responsibility to make substantial connections to the continent and assist in its development. You know, the Pan-African reality that even preceded Garvey clearly understood that the identity, the health, the well-being, the status of black people anywhere in the world, status of Africa in the world, and that as long as Africa is stepped on and underdeveloped, you know, we're going to continue to suffer no matter where we live. I'm of the mindset that, you know, Africa is where I live, where I stand. I'm an African, and I was born in an African city called Brooklyn, New York. You know, it is perhaps one of the most Pan-African cities in the world. We have people from every part of the world, every corner of the African world. All the Caribbean is represented there. All of the continent is represented there. And it is as much African as Kumasi or Lagos or Dakar. We're African where we are.
Exactly. So we're transcending those boundaries again. But before we get too far, for those who want to assist Marvin in their own way, one of the things you can do is go to his website, marvinsin.com. And I think you could actually buy the items on your website, too. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
And I will tell people, if you're looking for Target, I know Marvin may not like this, but let me just say, if you're looking for Target quality, you won't find it on his website. Because one thing I always admired about yourself is my ability to look at it.
I take it as a matter of responsibility that as an African artist that I'm required to create excellence because that's a reflection of our cultural heritage. That's who we are in the world. And
yeah, but you know, sometimes people have different levels that they're trying to reach, and oftentimes when they see a black artisan, they expect you to create something that's will be sold at, I won't pick a store, but go ahead.
No, I hear you. I hear you. I know. I mean, I've, you know, I've run into that over the years, but, you know, the work that I create has no peer. I mean, I have particularly studied the finest leather craft and leather designs in the world. And for the most part, you know, what people are selling is their brand name, their label. But a bag is a bag. But I am selling original art on every single piece of leather that I've ever created. And
I think it's also the look and the quality of the material, though.
I mean, it's that, but, you know, the designer bag craze is more about status than the object.
Gotcha.
People will spend $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $10,000 for a bag so that other people will know that they have spent $10,000 for a bag. I mean, the bag is a bag. It's, you know, there's nothing specifically distinguishing it from another bag. The pieces I create are original works of art. I've never duplicated anything in 50 years. And everyone who has one of my bags and wears it out in the world is, you know, constantly accosted by people admiring their work, that piece of that they're carrying. And I'm not making this up. This is just, you know, the history of the phenomenon. And so much so that, you know, my clientele is fairly limited, but the people who buy from me, more than likely, they have 10 or 15 bags. I mean, they keep coming back because of the experience that they've had with them. You know, I don't think you can say that with any other designer products. But again, it's the attitude that this must be perfect. It must be the best it can be because we are the best.
Yeah,
you know, and
we only got 3 more minutes. I want to get two more questions in, so I might have to cut you off to
go
get
ahead.
These in here.
Okay.
But what was one of your biggest challenges, and in hindsight, what would you have avoided while you was in Ghana? What was one of your biggest challenges, and how would you have avoided it?
I don't know. I think the biggest, detour was attempting, I guess, to be a little too grandiose. We were attempting a project that I, you know, I really loved and really, you know, invested a lot of energy in, but it was kind of counter the culture that we were in. We were trying to do something that was against the grain of the environment that we were working in, and it just never came to fruition. So it's, I guess, the key is adaptability, flexibility, and being open and aware of the environment and kind of take clues from the people who are there as opposed to trying to superimpose my idea or any other idea. You know, bring an open mind to the continent. And, you know, I think it will fill your mind with infinite possibilities, where if you come with a preconceived notion, your mind is closed and you will not see the other opportunities available. You know?
Good. And our last question, our last minute, where does this project go next?
Production is kind of a test case. We're attempting also to invite other artisans to follow this example, to have their work produced on the continent. So we've developed relationships with other craft producers in jewelry and fashion and woodwork and carving. So if that's something that somebody does, there's an opportunity to have that work created in Africa, in Ghana specifically right now.
Okay. Well, Marvin, I want to thank you so much for your time and for your enlightenment. And, of course, it's at marvinsin.com. And for those who are on our website or go to our website, you will find the link there. It'll be there permanently. Of course, go to portofharlem.net to read the latest issue. And if you're on Facebook, please like us. So thanks again, Marvin. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be with our next guest. So thanks again, Marvin.
Thank you, Wayne. I appreciate it.
All right, take care.
Peace.
Okay, we're going to take one second, and then we'll go to our next guest, Dr. Ida Jones. Hello, Ida, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good evening, Mr. Young.
Well, yes. So welcome back to Port of Harlem Talk Radio, and you can also visit portofharlem.net and click Port of Harlem Talk Radio in the menu to hear this and past episodes. Once again, our next guest is archivist and historian Dr. Ida Jones, who also identifies as a Holiness Pentecostal. In this episode, Ida shares stories of early encounters between Christians and Native Americans in New England. We hold this discussion in light of the Little Lights Urban Ministry sponsoring a series of courses titled Racial Literacy 101. Ida, in a nutshell, in no more than 2, 3, 4 sentences, how were these first encounters between white Christians and Native Americans?
On the surface, they were harmless. However, in terms of the nature of hygiene, they were lethal because the disease and the bacteria that had been inoculated by the nature of Europeans did not affect them, but it literally decimated tens of thousands of indigenous people in what we now know as modern New England.
Wow, so it was lethal. So they brought diseases with them that the Native Americans can handle?
Yes.
So that's the same thing that pretty much happened in the islands too, wasn't it?
The entire Western Hemisphere experienced that. When an ecosystem is able to survive with its own sense of immunity by barriers, being at sea or ocean or land barriers, then they can actually survive. But when a foreign entity is brought in volume with various pestilence and disease that they have a built-in immunity to, and they transmit that, then it causes problems. And that's
okay.
Basically what happened.
Is there a relationship between the early white Christian encounters with the Native Americans and those between white Christians and Africans?
There's very parallel streams of influence and conquest. And what happens is that initially when Europeans eventually become seafaring, thousands of years after African people had already discovered the idea of seafaring and had traveled around the globe many, many times, millennia ahead of Europeans. Europeans saw for themselves, because of the limited nature of their land, the limited nature of the resources that could be made profitable by the land because of the climate, they saw opportunities bountiful and boundless opportunities in, quote, tropical or alternative climates where people of color, African, Asian, indigenous people were living.
And so what were some of the typical things that you saw between the Native Americans and white Christians in New England and those between white Christians and Africans?
Well, short of the disease and that issue, then the next thing is going to be the idea of kidnapping and, quote, forcible education. So what happens with the colonizing influence of their imperialism is they send out explorers to explore and trade, then they eventually send out religious outposts and educational systems, then they eventually populate with businesses and industry. And relatively that order is not within those three top ways. And as they infiltrate the culture, they exploit the differences to the benefit of the imperialistic or the colonizing force.
And, you know, when you say that, it sounds, frankly, kind of rough. But in reality, it reminds me of being in third grade history class, because that's what we were taught, but in nice manners. I mean, I learned that Father Marquette came to Northwest Indiana, and he was a friend of the Native Americans, and he tried to make them Catholics. And next thing you know, their land was gone.
And they viewed it as a way in which that God had given these early first century Western Christians the idea that this was God's right, that God had given them the right by divine authority to be able to either convert or conquer anyone or any civilization that was anti-Christian. So they actually believed with great religious fervor that they were doing the, quote, Lord's work.
So it gives a new meaning to the word from sea to shining sea.
Yes, exactly.
Would you say that?
Yeah, exactly. And so what I call it is cultural shrapnel, in the sense that these people had culture, they had identity, they had structure to their order for thousands of years, at least 10,000 years, like the Aboriginal persons of Australia. So they didn't just arrive. They had order and structure. But with the ethnocentrism or the narrowness of the white cultural filter, it was a vertical relationship where there was white on top and everything was subordinate to that. Their God, their ways, their thoughts, their dress, their diet, their everything was superior to anyone and everyone else. And that mindset that comes out of the Greco-Roman era of conquest and domination is literally within their bloodstream. And it's frightening to see because that cultural shrapnel still exists, where now you have people such as indigenous Hawaiians who want their space back, some indigenous Puerto Ricans who want their space back, because at some point they lost themselves, and then, of course, would never be fully human in the eyes of the imperialistic forces. So you were almost like in a purgatory. You couldn't be in heaven because you're not one of us, and then you're not quite in hell, but you'll never be fully anything. You'll be...
So like a half white person or I guess what you call the octoroons and the quadroons and the mixed race kids, they're not quite African, but they're definitely not white.
There you go. And then your culture also now becomes this lesser thing. So when the book that I was telling you about that I'm looking at, this is actually the PBS station here in the Washington area had one on the Pilgrims and talked about it, but with the first encounter with the Wampanoag people of New England, which is current-day Massachusetts, it's called Faith and Boundaries, Colonist Christianity and Communities Among the Wampanoag Indians of Martha's Vineyard. So he starts out with a story of one person who was kidnapped and brought to London. His name was Epinau, or the European name was Epinau, and he was basically like Otabinga, living in a human zoo, where people would actually see these kinds of captured oddities from around the world. So he was able to convince the European greed enough to go back to, quote, the New World, because he said there's gold there. You can be so wealthy. You'd be twice as wealthy, 100 times wealthier. So they were driven by their greed to come back. And then he told his people, when they came out to meet the ship, come back and rescue me. And his own native language, because he was now bilingual, because he could speak English and he could also speak the Wampanoag dialect and language. And when they came, they just simply took him away. They didn't seek to kill anybody. But, of course, that meant with extreme oppression and extreme crushing defeat when they realized they were betrayed, the Europeans were betrayed.
So now that sounds like when you said that, you made it like just a statement, but that scared me. Because you're saying that there was this museum, because it sounded like it must have been a museum with lots of other people in there, because I remember the story of Venice Hottentot. So were they in the same museum?
Sarah Bartman, yep. That was 16th, 17th, and it definitely becomes much more heightened in the 19th century, where these, quote, oddities, where they were
But so you're telling me that she herself was not the only person that was held in one of these human museums. There were other people human museums.
No.
You're joking.
No.
I wish you were joking.
We had a domestic situation here with the conjoined twins, Millie Christine, who were conjoined twins born into enslavement here in this country. And they were also kind of used as, quote, like sideshows. We now call them freak shows in the 20th century, which is derogatory as well. But these kind of human oddities.
I do
and
remember
Otabinga.
That being
a...
Mm-hmm. Now, I do remember, in Americans at least, where the... circuses would have people of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
So before the circus, you're saying this was taking place in Europe, that they had museums. People would go to a museum and see these humans, like this Native American and like Venus. I think she's in Angola somewhere.
South Africa.
South Africa.
The Western Cape, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they would have those. So they would have these people in these museums. That's real.
And
that's
I guess
real.
What happens is because the climate is very foreign to them, once again with the diseases and other things like that, Sarah Bartman met with a great fate, and it wasn't until almost 220 years that her remains were actually given back to the Khoisan people of South Africa for formal burial. So they literally kept her body and bones and studied them and exploited her physically, emotionally, and possibly sexually as well. And even in death, they exploited her. So it wasn't until about 5 or 10 years ago in this century that her bones were repatriated back to the Khoisan people for proper funeral burial according to the customs of them, the Khoisan. It's sad,
wow.
But this is what we're living in. And so as a result, when we talk about this idea of cultural shrapnel in the wake of the, quote, race awakening of reckoning of 2020, I have turned an interesting eye to the indigenous people of America, the Native Americans, and the hundreds, if not thousands, of tribal groups that are comprised, some that are fully decimated because of the way in which they were destroyed, not just simply by Europeans' disease and graft and corruption. They would actually play them against each other. So I'm not sure if it was the Narragansett or the there's so many different tribes, but the Wampanoag had been a fearsome group, and they kind of encountered a lot of enemies. So when the Europeans came and could possibly empower a weaker adversary, they would join forces to undermine the Wampanoag. So they didn't realize until after the decimation of almost all of them, we should have formed a confederation amongst ourselves against the Europeans. But that came so late. And then there were individuals who benefited from kind of running like Matahari double spy, double agent things to the benefit of themselves and to the detriment of the indigenous and the financial benefit of the Europeans. So human nature is so interesting and all that.
Well, I did read one review of the book that said that their adoption of Christianity and other selective borrowing from English culture contributed to Indian-English coexistence and their downfall. Can you speak more on that?
Yes, because what happens when you don't have what they had in the Caribbean, which is very nice, like in Cuba and various parts of South America, the term is called syncretism, where you could blend your indigenous belief with this kind of colonist or imperialistic belief and understand this, because they have a worldview. But when you now totally erase my worldview and impose your worldview, then a part of me dies, because my naming, my diet, my design, my worldview is attached to my people, my language. And so when you eradicate that, even the deity, or we'll call the, I'm trying to find my theological terms, but your worldview, your heaven view, or your God view is replaced with someone else's, then it's no longer organically yours. And in most first world cultures, well, they call them third world, but they really are first world cultures, that connected you to your ancestors and to that deity and that sense of your being in a continuum. When you disrupt that,
right,
and you break that, now I am literally rootless. I don't know who I am. I can't speak the language of my ancestors. I can't communicate with them because that's considered necromancy, you know, according to some Judeo-Christian beliefs. So as a result, when you're not allowing the cultural filter to blend on some levels, not in terms of one's faith or one's practice or belief, but to understand that someone could actually have a cultural filter, like with the voodoo in Haiti. And they have great cultural filters that have been blended with the Catholic Church. They did the same thing in Santeria in Cuba, where they blend it with the Catholic Church. So there's an Africanism, and then there's this kind of imperialistic colonial religion that they're also blending and finding parallels to their cultural understanding. They were able to have intentions.
While we're on this piece of the subject, let me just throw this into you. I got this from Fodi Baldi, one of my readers from the Gambia. He said, he sent this to me earlier. We made a meme out of our Facebook page. He said, speak your native language to your children or watch it die within the next 20 years. Looking down on your relatives who speak your native tongue because you speak perfect English is stupid. It's like being proud of borrowed clothes.
That's a very profound statement, being proud
yeah.
of borrowed clothes.
Yeah.
And that was the kind of that shrapnel that some of those individuals who benefited from being very proud and showboating in those borrowed clothes in the indigenous community did to the greater detriment of all of them. And
okay,
I think Angela Davis had said it in the 60s, if they come for you a day, they're going to come for me at night. So it wasn't a matter of I'm helping sell out the people from Indiana and I live in Massachusetts. All of us will lose if we don't defend against the common enemy or the common threat. And it wasn't realized till too late that the common threat and the common enemy should have been attacked a different way. But the beauty of it is that these peoples have been allowed to somewhat reconvene and reassess themselves to a far more decimated vantage point than they were when they were flourishing.
Go ahead. I just want to make sure.
I'm saying the people in Namibia, like the people in Namibia, the Harawe people, I think they are, and what the Germans had done to them in Namibia. So they're now going to the world courts to get money and kind of reparations for that, because you literally decimated the pot. It's just genocide. It's genocide.
Well, I want to get back to the core. We talked about coexisting and how that benefits people, and then how that how the coexisting also becomes your downfall.
I think what happens with first world culture people is they don't understand the depravity of Europeans. And even with Christianity, and this is a conversation I had with the Little Lights when I did a talk for them, and I've done some other classes for Christian persons to understand the kind of cloudy filter that the Western Church views Christianity, and they weaponize it. When in fact, if it was taught the way it was lived out by Jesus Christ, it's actually liberating. So because of the cultural filter that is based on greed and dominance, that is strictly European and in a larger part human, but principally has been extracted in the last 200 years by or 400 years by what Europeans, doesn't allow for the expression of joining. It's either my way or your destruction. So even though it might start off when they're, quote, civilizing schools, like Hampton was one, where they would, quote, bring the Native Americans in and they'd show you pictures of them and, quote, their savage dress is how they like to refer to them. And then how after 4 years or 5 years of being inculcated with this Western mindset, they're now, quote, seated in their right minds, dressed in Western dress with their hair cut and other things like that, that is visually appealing to Europeans, not understanding what hair and dress and adornment mean to our people. So once again, being proud of those borrowed clothes.
Yeah, I know. It seems like for some people who are following, I'm sorry, because I know there's some people say we're going down so many different rabbit holes, but that's one thing, you know, we enjoy talking to each other, because I understood exactly what you were saying when you make these connections. And we can keep going on and on and talk about these different connections. And here's another connection. And once we took a tour of Hampton as a part of a tour for us to write a travel story, and we learned so much about Hampton and everything, and that one little piece you just mentioned was in a sentence. I mean, 3 days' worth of Hampton and what you just said was a sentence. And so you walk away not putting much importance on what you just said, but it struck me so badly because I said, you know, they treat these Native Americans like they were black.
Well, that was it. And in the book, as well as the idea of, quote, civilizing the savage as the Christians thought they were doing, they realized they were hopeless because eventually they would run away because they knew the terrain. So then they turned their eyes to the, quote, African as the next possible civilizing person, because they're also equal savages. But if we civilize them by Christianizing them, we could make them better workers. So it was always in this kind of weaponized effort at missionary work to Christianize people for service, not for salvation.
Yeah,
and
but they were
so
all...
that becomes a big issue.
Oh, yeah. But sometimes people say it's for salvation. But then I guess when you look at the Negro, when you learn about the Negro Bible and all this type of stuff, it makes you re-question everything. And just being in Hampton and seeing that one little statement about the Native American, how it was an African American and a Native American university, and what the purpose was and how they transformed these Native Americans, it was like, oh no, this is just sad. You weren't there to uplift them. You were there to somehow make them to something that you want them to be. And, you know, Jonathan French also did a story that's very popular on our magazine's website about going to Australia. And he talked about those things, too, about how the Australians had done pretty much the same thing to the Aborigines.
Yep. Everywhere they go, and it's almost like white death. And this also ties in, of course, because we're having this, it's called, again, stream of consciousness conversation, that there is now a Netflix anime on an African samurai, Yasuke, And he was also a captive of the Catholic Church, Portuguese, I believe, and traveled throughout the various parts of the eastern region and eventually lands in Japan. And they actually asked to wash him because they never had seen an African person. They thought he had tattooed his skin or he was dirty. And he eventually rises in the rank under the I don't want to say shogun, but the leader, Oba Nobunaga. And so he becomes the first non-native or foreign person to be a samurai. And he has an amazing career. And there's a Chadwick Boseman, the late Chadwick Boseman, was to play him in a feature film that's coming out. But it's just a fascinating thing. Africans are everywhere. They've been everywhere. We were the first people. And
okay.
So the others have shot off of us. So when you look at first world people and their contributions, you see such growth. But when you look at other European contributions, you see a level of death. And it's not that this is to indict any one particular person, but it shows you the impetus for what drives their culture, greed and conquest.
So let me ask you these two questions again, but let's try to stick to just one. Let's just get a sentence out of you. So how did the Native Americans and the English, or how did Native Americans in particular, benefit from coexisting with the Native, with the English?
They benefited from being able to survive because they could have been totally obliterated. So we know that it's the Plymouth Rock where they have this every year as a Native New Englander, the Native Americans protest during what we call Thanksgiving. I think they call it a day of mourning in terms of how their people were decimated. And then actually in this documentary that PBS had done, they actually said that when the second wave of Europeans came, they actually would make their settlements on the actual graves of the Wampanoag, which they said, you don't do that. You don't desecrate land where people are dead. And I guess the disease that had been so, I don't know if it was like a flux or some kind of other germ, but people were dying so rapidly they didn't even have a chance to bury each other. So there were human remains literally scattered in various villages because people were dying at such a rapid clip, and there was no one around strong enough to bury the dead. And so literally these Europeans would just push corpses and push bones aside and set up a camp. So to the living person, they were like, that is ghastly. What kind of savage are they? So I think the idea of cooperation and trying to build a bridge of understanding to these very foreign people was to their benefit because they were able to survive. We have
okay.
people now who are native-born who are surviving.
Okay, and then the adoption of Christianity and other selective borrowing from English culture also contributes to their downfall. In a sentence or two, how did this coexistence help in their downfall?
It suppressed their culture for at least several hundred years, and what was taught openly through rites of passage or other kinds of cultural acts had to go underground. And it's not until the last 50, maybe to 100 years that those things are now surfacing, where they're having these powwows and other kinds of cultural activities openly without fear of repression or without fear of being misjudged. So I think you look at their the detriment was, and some actually there was one just passed away, I forget, somewhere in the Midwest. He was the last person who spoke the language of his tribe. And he was in his mid to late 90s. And I believe he was recorded. But he was the last native speaker. So when you are unable to transmit, like the man said from the Gambia, to speak your native tongue to your children, and even on the quote reservations, they're taught to speak English, and native tongue is considered bad. Even in Hawaii, same thing. You don't speak native language. So the idea that you're going to school where you're getting a grade and you're told that you need to do this, and you're being punished for being your organic self, that's a detriment. So I think as of the last 50 to 100 years, we're now seeing a reawakening that those things that were kept alive underground are being surfaced, and the young people are asking, tell me who I am, connect me with my past. And it's beautiful.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And this conversation is really affecting also how we create our next exhibit in the Gambia, believe me.
Awesome.
You usually, yeah, it really is. You really explore African-American history. How did you find reading this history book and the book above that we spoke of, Faith and Boundaries, Colonists, Christianity, and Community among the Wampanoag Indians of Martha's Vineyard, 1600 to 1871. How'd you find reading this history book, and tell us a little bit more about it?
I found it because I was fascinated by this documentary that I had seen on PBS during the lockdown in 2020. And they actually had Native persons who were anthropologists, historians, and sociologists talking about the history of the first encounter. And this is contrary to that third grade history you're talking about. And they were very fact, because they're academically trained. What happened to their people? Unapologetic about what really happened. And so this was the first documentary that I have seen in which indigenous people were allowed to speak for themselves with, quote, the academic training. Because in the Western society, if you don't have a PhD and you're not a this or that, you really don't have, quote, weight here. But these were academically trained, letter-holding professionals who also happened to be indigenous. And they were able to read the science, read the reports, and understand what happened to their people. And that was very moving to me. So then I looked at these other books to kind of understand, how did they live? What happened to them? Because if you look at various towns throughout this country, various names for various places, even here in Anacostia, that was a tribe
right.
of people.
Exactly.
Pawuxin, so that there's all these, so you see these names like, well, what's that? Like the dinosaur, a T-Rex, or a, Triceratops. Like, ooh, what's that? Like a dinosaur? That didn't really happen. So you dismiss an entire people because of the way scholarship has been framed and the way in which we are viewing things through an ethnocentric lens, even as African people, because we've been raised in this environment.
Exactly.
And so to see them is to give them voice and also to give myself voice, that there's a lot of us on the outside. And we're asking to be let in. Time is tearing those walls down. Now there's no more fight. It's just we're now numerically and intellectually in a space where we will now have a seat at the table, because the table now has shifted.
And I guess that's why we have these insurrections on January 21st?
Exactly. January 6th, because there is a death of whiteness globally. It's happening globally. And the same way the sun would never set, the sun is setting now. The sun is setting on the Western Empire.
Yeah, because the tables have turned, and they're passing laws all over the country. There was one passed in Oklahoma, I believe, last week. We have an article coming up in the next issue of Port of Harlem about this, about the death of the 1776 Commission, which was awful, and the 1619 project being able to breathe. But at the same time, states are still passing laws saying you can't have critical race theory, and that we pretty much get against the law for you and I to have this type of discussion in the school.
Well, there was also a recent decision in Oklahoma where they gave the eastern part of the state back to the indigenous people, because Oklahoma was populated by those who were forced to walk on the Trail of Tears in the 1840s. And then after they forced them from Georgia and Florida and other places to walk thousands of miles and literally die on the walk, then they opened it up to the Europeans and said, free land, take whatever you want. You just put me out of my native home, told me this is where I'm supposed to be. Now all of a sudden these other people are coming to speculate.
Yeah.
So Oklahoma has a very rich history.
Well, we only have about 2 minutes left. So how does this history affect us today?
It affects us because if we are humane and if we have a conscience and if we listen to what Angela Davis said, if they come for me in the day, they're coming for you at night. If we don't safeguard the least of these and value their story, we will soon be one of those smaller voices that will be considered of no value.
So that means we need to be vigilant about all these little things like the 1776 Commission, the 1619 Project, what's going on in Oklahoma and other states, et cetera?
Yes, if you look at one of my colleagues talks about whether it's Mount Rushmore, which is also a sacred mountain for the indigenous people. If you look at the iconography of America, our presidents, our money, our idea of what an American looks like, from C. Dick and Jane Run with Spot, or the Fred Flintstones or the Jessup Jetsons. When you look at the iconography of America, there's people that are not included. And that's all of us who are not included. So it's only 1% included and 99% unincluded, even white women to some extent. And so as a result, one has to ask themselves, is that who the world is? White and male, that's all the world is? Where do I see myself? Where do I fit in? And then where does this other person who looks like me, because they don't, where do they fit in?
Okay.
So that
becomes
the question.
Well, in the last 5 seconds, I want to thank you again for this wonderful conversation. And please, people, portofharlem.net. Subscriptions are free, and please like us on Facebook. And again, thanks so much, Ida.
Thank you so much, Wayne.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Hi, thanks for listening in. Hi, thanks for listening in. No, I thought that was good. Yeah, I'm glad you work on Black University so you can say what you say. That's your work on. So your work on White University called in. Ms. Jones, for the white board won't call you in on Monday. Well, I mean that my friend Tony in his piece of the magazine said, well, it's he said it's uneven, and I think I agree with him pretty much. It's uneven. And some of these people are still more crazy.
Exactly. And you see how we can tell them when you get to the point where they just didn't say that was an introduction. Oh my God, we did not say that.
I'm Okay, I was told to tell you happy Mother's Day. Okay. Yeah, you would be another radio show. Right. Well, I thought you said you don't like TVs in the room anyway. Uh-huh. one street. He's at one corner, one street. No, they still have talk show.
So that they come on my, they come on my laptop.
Oh, you want to go in your kitchen? Darius coming to your house all the time, and he and you going to
lock there. Yeah, I don't know where you at lock, right? Or where you at boy? Because you and Derek can do that together. Michael Jackson story. No, it was in the newspaper there. And so you take the article and you can put it on Facebook, which is on the internet, and then everybody can see it and make, you know how you wrote that note on their page about I like this program, love more. Well, you can do that on Facebook, and then everybody sees it, and they can make their comment. Yeah, we all did. Just like you wrote the comment, enjoyed the program, Mom Louise. Well, somebody wrote the comment. Yeah, that's my, somebody wrote the comment. I remember Miss Theo, and she was my teacher and things like that.
Okay.